Hi everyone, I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from New York City, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Serious topics with scholars and knowledgeable people dealing with the issues that we rarely hear in the mainstream media, and certainly not in objective ways. Today's topic, the new Kashmir crisis and growing tensions between India and Pakistan. Have you read anything about it? Heard anything about it? Do you even know where Kashmir is on a map? Well, you will by the end of this interview. My guest, speaking to us by Skype, is Farooq Katwari. He is an internationally respected Kashmiri American business person who's been the chairman and president and CEO of the furniture chain store Ethan Allen Interiors, now with outlets across America and Canada and Europe and the Middle East. In 1985, at the age of 41, Farooq was selected as company president and continues to hold this position as of today. And aside from his business acumen and reputation for making Ethan Allen one of the most employee-friendly corporations in America, he has also been a leading thought leader in international attempts to keep the tensions between India and Pakistan from going over the top, especially over Kashmir, and to restore the original international policies that provided Kashmiris a degree of autonomy. Now, recently, Kashmir has again reached global headlines after India's Hindu nationalist Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, placed the Indian-controlled region into a military lockdown and rounded up about 400 of Kashmir's democratically elected politicians and officials and separatist intellectuals who continue to sit in Kashmir's overflowing prisons under terrible conditions. And besides his diplomatic efforts, Farooq is also a founder of the Kashmir Study Group that created the Livingston Proposal as a peaceful initiative to bring stability to Kashmir's divisions. He is the chair of Refugees International and the co-chair of the Muslim Jewish Advisory Council, started during the election of Trump to fight against hate speech and crimes targeting Jews and Muslims. And last week, Farooq's personal autobiographical tale of Trailblazer, From the Mountains of Kashmir to the Summit of Global Business and Beyond, was published, which includes the history and political background of the Kashmir crisis and this intermediary activities to bring sanity between India's and Pakistan's governments. Now, that said, I'd like to welcome you to our program.
Well, it is a pleasure to be on the program, and thank you for the introduction that you have given.
Good. For the past 30 years, when violence and militancy skyrocketed in India-controlled Kashmir in 1988, we've heard different geoanalysts and historians warn that the crisis could be a triggering point for a nuclear weapons exchange between India and Pakistan. In fact, 2 years ago, the leader of one of India's right-wing ultra-Hindu nationalist parties suggested India drop a nuclear bomb on Pakistan for creating tensions at its border with Kashmir. Unfortunately, the U.S.'s mainstream media gives almost no attention to this hot zone on the planet and that has been waging for decades now. I might add that in a similar way, the media ignores the plight of Palestinians living in inhumane conditions in Gaza. Well, 2 weeks ago, Pakistan's newly elected Prime Minister, Imran Khan, a former international cricket celebrity, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times. I happen to respect Khan as one of the best leaders Pakistan has had in a long time. He is a progressive moderate who, during his 1 year in office, has made several attempts to stabilize relationships with India's Prime Minister Modi in order to reach to negotiate a peaceful resolution over the Kashmir issue. However, all of his efforts have been ignored. And in fact, India canceled a scheduled meeting between the two leaders at the United Nations General Assembly last September. Then last month, at midnight on August 5th, India put all of Kashmir into a military lockdown and cut off all of its communications to the outside world. Over 50,000 additional Indian troops were moved into the region, bringing the total number over to 1 million troops for a population of approximately 12 million citizens. And civil rights and humanitarian organizations have been slowly leaking reports of rampant arrest, torture, rape, and also indiscriminate deaths. And Modi's government reneged on the international recognizing of Articles 35A and 370 in the Indian Constitution that permits Kashmir a degree of autonomy over its local governance and the policy that only Kashmiris can own property in the region. I took some extra time to summarize briefly the crisis unfolding now. However, there is a background history to Kashmir that the average person never hears about. Perhaps many listeners would be unable to locate Kashmir on a map or know that Kashmir is divided into three separate regions controlled by India, Pakistan, and China separately. It is both religiously and racially diverse, yet it's been the victim of conflicts between India and Pakistan since the partition in 1947. So I'll ask you to begin by providing us with a comprehensive history of Kashmir, the fact that it was not recognized as part of India during Gandhi and Nehru's independence movement, and had its own indigenous national movement. And finally, why is this mountainous Himalayan region regarded as so important for India and Pakistan that the two countries would engage in a nuclear exchange over it? Take your time, please. The forum is yours.
Well, thank you very much, and you have given a lot of information. Obviously, my perspective is that, I was born in Kashmir. I was born in a family that was involved in, you might say, Kashmiri movement, both for purposes of on the political side, as also involved with business. So our families got separated because of the conflict of Kashmir being divided into the two areas. So I, at the age of just under five, with parts of our family, one of my older brother and sister stayed on the other side, we became refugees. So we've gone through this. And I was able to, fortunately, come to America at age 20. And it was interesting. The coming to America was due to the fact that there was an event that really went back to 1983. That has consequences today. This was an event late December, if I remember, 1983, that a government installed by India was removed by India at that time, and they felt and the person who they removed felt that they're going to teach India that they still need him. So there's a very big shrine in Kashmir in which the relic, the hair of the Prophet Muhammad is kept, and a lot of Kashmiris believe it is a tremendously important relic. And many other Muslims, other places may not really have those kind of perspectives. So it is said that this prime minister at that time of Kashmir, installed by India, had removed it. And about 2 million people at that time, maybe over the population of less than five, started moving towards this shrine. I was a cricket player. I was playing cricket in Delhi in India, and decided to come back, and sitting next to me was an American journalist from the Washington Evening Star. I asked him, who's going to take you around? And he said, I don't know. I said, I will. So anyway, I took him around and got deeply into what you might say the Kashmir conflict. He later on introduced me to a diplomat, an American diplomat, and then of course, a lot of other factors came into place, and I ended up in America. However, my involvement in Kashmir has continued from that time to see how we can come with a peaceful resolution. And it was actually in the early, late 80s when a government, there was an election, and I'm now talking about the Indian administered Kashmir, And it is said that the people who won were not given the opportunity by the administration that was again controlled by India, and many of these people became militants, and a movement started in which Pakistan also got involved in the sense of helping the militants, which does not help the situation, and India acted somewhat similar to what they have done now in 1990 in terms of sending more soldiers, having people stay behind in their homes, took out the tourists and others at that time. And things became very, very bad. And it was in 1994 that I was approached by the Indians, their leadership, to see if I could come and help the situation, meet the people. So I went to Kashmir, to India, and I said, I've got to meet the Kashmiri leaders, who many of them were in jail. So I went to the jail, saw them, and asked them. I said, you know, what is your plan? And unfortunately, they also didn't have a plan. I went to the Indians. They felt that force will take care of it. I went to the Pakistan leadership on the other side, met them, and they also felt that somehow the United Nations will intervene, others will intervene, and this will, and perhaps some militancy will take care of it. And it was at that stage I realized that we needed to give some ideas of where we should go, because my objective was to help bring some sort of a sensible way out of this situation.
Could hold on 1 second. I believe that the whole story could best be served if you gave us a historical look at Kashmir from its beginning. What made Kashmir unique among areas that in that area of the world? So we have no understanding of Kashmir's. We have no understanding of its topography, of what
yes.
made it special. So why don't you give that background as well, please?
I was about to do that. It's an excellent point, because one of the things I realized at that time was how little the leaders in India, Pakistan, and even some Kashmir leaders knew about the history of Kashmir. Now, as you rightly said, some highlights. The main area of conflict is what's called the Kashmiri-speaking areas. This area enjoyed intermittent periods of independence going back over 1,000 years. If you ask Kashmir, they'll say, we lost our independence, you know, not many years back, but it was in 1586. Kashmir lost its independence to the treachery of the king's brother, who conspired to have the Mughal Akbar was emperor of India, to take control of Kashmir. And he made Kashmir into a province of the Mughal Empire, as they were doing in other places. The Mughals expanded this Kashmir area, which is the Kashmiri-speaking areas, to include what is the north of Kashmir called Ladakh and Baltistan areas. This is an area where the people are generally more Tibetan-speaking. Now, with British wanting to control the increasing Russian influence, they first gave control, that was with the ending of the Mughal Empire, they first gave control of Kashmir to the Afghans. And in late 1700s, that's when they gave control to Afghanistan. In 1812, the British decided to take control of Afghanistan themselves because, again, of concern of Russia. And they then had put the Sikhs, another minority, to rule over Punjab, because the whole policy was divide and rule, a minority to rule over majority. So they gave Sikhs the control of Kashmir. And the British invaded Afghanistan, but they lost, and they then decided that they should get control of Punjab from the Sikhs. And so what they did was they decided that they conspired with a small ruler next to Kashmir and in a province called Jammu, which was really part of the Punjab area. And in 1846, they gave Kashmir to the control of these folks who ruled Jammu, and it just became Jammu and Kashmir. Now, it was not only they gave control to the ruler of Jammu, they actually sold Kashmir, and the Kashmiris call it the infamous treaty of Amritsar, and the agreement stated that the people, the land, and the animals, and the birds of Kashmir are sold to the Dogras. Now, the Kashmiris remember it. the people around them may not. So the history of Kashmir has been very, it was harsh for the Kashmiris since 1586. The people who are the Dogras of Jammu, that's what they're called. They spoke a language called Punjabi, which is, you know, the language spoken in that part of the subcontinent. They're very little in common with the people of Kashmir. Their rule was extremely harsh, and in the 1930s, a Quit Kashmir movement was started. And actually, the first meeting was held in my grandfather's house in Kashmir, in Srinagar, the capital of Kashmir, where I was born. And this is where the movement started. And again, the history is that one of the leaders of Kashmir, his name was Sheikh Abdullah, he made a treaty with India, along with, at that time, the Dogra ruler, so that that Jammu and Kashmir would join India with having certain elements of autonomy, including this provision where no Indians could purchase property from Kashmir. So the Kashmir history is such. What I found out was that the leaders, as I said earlier, of India, Pakistan, even Kashmir didn't understand this history. So the problem of Kashmir really is being that it is like something like the former Yugoslavia, where number of areas were put together, and with people with different ethnic backgrounds, different languages, in some cases different religions, and the area is called Jammu and Kashmir, where the main area of conflict is the Kashmiri-speaking area, and that's where the focus has to be. So when in early when I got involved in it, and in the early 90s, and were able to establish a group called the Kashmir Study Group, with the involvement of both India and Pakistan and many leaders of the Kashmir region, to find a way out. And we then had many discussions. I spent time in India, I spent time in Pakistan, spent time in the regions of Kashmir, and we made lots of progress. And one of the main objectives was to make people of that region understand the unique history of Kashmir. So a Kashmir Way Forward proposal was developed with some leading scholars in geography, history, politics got involved. And the reason was that I felt that it was important for the leadership in India, Pakistan, and even in Kashmir to understand the history and to come with a sensible way out. And we developed what's called the Kashmir Way Forward. And the Way Forward was first developed the idea was concepts were worked out in a farm that we own ourselves in Livingston, New York. So it's called the Livingston Proposal. The Livingston Proposal became the basis of discussions for about at least 10 years. And this proposal was developed in consultation with persons from the Jammu and Kashmir region, from both sides of the line of control, and with the Indians and the Pakistanis. And the proposals explored the ideas of creating self-governing regions on both sides of the line of control. The proposals were given to government officials in India, Pakistan, and a diverse leadership in Jammu and Kashmir region. And we made lots of progress. However, the differences between India and Pakistan did not take it forward. So my perspective is that we have to look at opportunities which would create peace, because certainly what is taking place right now is even worse than what took place in the early 90s. And we've got to find what I've always described, to come to have a peaceful, honorable, and a feasible solution.
Okay. I read a short biography years ago about the father of Kashmir independence from the British, Sheikh Abdullah, that you just mentioned, who eventually became its prime minister, but was imprisoned by Nehru. And what I recall is that Nehru admired something in the Sheikh's movement that he found lacking in Gandhi's strategy, and that was the strong cohesiveness and unity between the different religions in Kashmir's home of Muslims, both Sunni and Shia, and Hindus and Sikhs, and Tibetan Buddhists, and even tribal cultures. Yet throughout most of its history, aside from outside invaders, Kashmiris have sustained deep religious tolerance and cooperation. They're very open to other religions, and many might say it's because it's due to their rich mystical traditions in Kashmiri history, especially Sufism, that played an important role in the region's culture and politics. And so we appreciate hearing your view, since you're from there. And then also we have you and your family were recently in Kashmir and left just before the surprise military occupation and blackout. And during your conversation with our producer yesterday, Richard Gale, you mentioned that you observed a growing tension and things were not right. What do you mean tension? How did it manifest, and what do you mean things were not right?
Well, there are a number of factors. We were there about 2 months back. We had a family wedding, and a number of things I sort of realized something was going to happen, because in the past when I went to Kashmir, I stopped in Delhi, and I would send a note to some of the high officials in Delhi who I had worked with in the past to see if we could have a conversation. There was no reply, silence. So I went to Kashmir and again tried to contact them, silence. And then I started seeing that troops were already being placed, soldiers at almost every street corner. Something did not look right to me in a situation where you don't want to have a soldier at every corner when it appeared that there was not any trouble taking place. And obviously, they were already planning to have this operation take place. And it happened just a week after we left Kashmir. And I've got a brother there, a sister there. My wife has her brother, sister. Lots of extended families are all there. And for the first few weeks, it was very, very hard to even talk to them, to know what is happening. Now, intermittently, we are able to get a phone call in some areas, not all areas, so we can understand what is taking place. So the conditions are very bad. The conditions are difficult. I think this question about, we hear that this is being done, so this will bring about economic development, it will bring about more jobs. I don't understand what the philosophy is, because this was done at a time of the high tourist season. Many Kashmiris, their income comes from tourism, and all the tourists were asked to leave. So I think that they've been planning, and the objective is to silence the Kashmiris, and I don't think
All you would have to do is look at what's happened to India. India has become a fascistic, nationalistic state under Modi. I mean, this man would be far right of the alt-right in the United States. And by every measure, he represents fascism in that area of the world. By the way, in the middle 1990s, after all hell broke loose in Kashmir, with various militant groups creating terror in the region, either indigenous separatist groups or jihadi groups aligned with Pakistan, and you founded the Kashmir Study Group that you mentioned earlier to find a solution to the conflict. That resulted, as you mentioned, in the Livingston proposal, and you gave us a little background on that and your successes and failures to sell the proposal to the Indian and Pakistani prime ministers, especially Modi, who is not going to accept anything that would nurture a positive dialogue and create peace in the region if he has other agendas. And he does have other agendas. And so that's going to be very frustrating. Now, some progressive journalists and historians have started to equate what is happening with India's strong-arm efforts to rule over Kashmir with Israel's control over Palestine. In Palestine, at least this audience would know that, there's been settler colonization over Palestinian lands. Now, Modi's disregard of Article 370 opens up the possibility for Indians and Indian corporations to begin colonizing Kashmir and privatizing its lands. In fact, I've been reading a little bit about how the Hindu nationalist BJP leadership has strengthened its ties and appreciation for Zionist extremism. Zionism, by the way, is a political movement, ideological movement. It is not a religious movement. The founder of Zionism was an atheist. Many of the Zionists today are atheists. which goes back to Gandhi's main enemy and father of Hindu nationalism, the gentleman who was called Savarkar, who was a supporter of Zionism's early efforts to create a Jewish state in Palestine back in the 1920s. Therefore, what do you perceive as being India's long-term goals for eradicating these two articles of the Indian Constitution?
Well, you have explained the fact that there is this whole question of their philosophy. The other is that they have taken a very hostile attitude towards Pakistan, and they believe that Pakistan is a troublemaker in Kashmir. They believe that they've got to stop any elements or influence of Pakistan in Kashmir, and this has been done to curb any influence from Pakistan, and secondly, to curb any perspectives of Kashmiris wanting to have either an independent entity or even a self-governing entity.
Well, you've been through several quarters of White House administrations, notably Clinton, Bush, and Obama, and the Council on Foreign Relations, many of their international bodies, to present the Kashmir situation to world leaders. How much is the international community and the United States government in particular really concerned over the Kashmir crisis, since generally whatever is of concern to the government in power in the United States, suddenly you start seeing it in the headlines and main stories and op-eds in the New York Times, Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. You're not seeing any of that now. So in my personal opinion, our nation's dealing with Israel and its crimes against Palestinians is unconscionable. So I do not personally see the international community of nations doing much over Kashmir. And Modi seems to have found a strong ally in Trump. They both have similar personalities, regressive, and they share similar racist and prejudiced national ideologies. Modi is not an intellect. Trump is the complete antithesis of intellectual. Neither one looks at the larger worldview nor the consequences of their actions. Both are extremely intemperate and prone to outbursts. And when you have a powerful person, Modi in India, Trump in the United States, you can have all forms of negative outcomes. Therefore, can we really expect anything to come from this administration in finding a solution to Kashmir?
Well, I think that the solution has to come from the region, and especially in India. I believe that a crisis can create an opportunity, and this is a crisis. And crisis is not only that is going to impact Kashmiris, but it might impact and is impacting few hundred million minorities in India, Muslims, Sikhs, and others. And there's a possibility that when you start something like this, this does not end in one place. Already, from what I've heard is the minorities in India are getting very concerned that what is taking place in Kashmir. So I believe the opportunity is more of something in India itself saying, people in India, different minorities in India saying, you know, we got to find a sensible way out of this. Now, what the sensible way is that this is what I am trying to get the message across to Indian leaders. That is, you have a tremendous opportunity right now in giving Kashmiris, and I'm talking the Kashmiri speaking people, where the problem is, give them an opportunity of self-rule. We use the word, give them sovereignty without an international personality. That was the Livingston proposal. That's what it said. And the Indians agreed to it.
Could I share a different opinion with yours, with due respect? I believe that's never going to happen. I believe that the single biggest problem that is the progenitor of all this conflict is water. The German state-run news outlet Deutsche Welle had an article earlier this year that forecast conflict between India and Pakistan over Kashmir is in part largely a struggle over water. What do I mean? Pakistan's Indus River Valley, which provides about 90% of the nation's food, depends heavily upon the six river heads originating in Kashmir. The 1960 Indus Water Treaty assured the rivers were divided equally in order to satisfy each nation's need. But given these recent efforts in the neocon government ruling in New Delhi, there's no reason to believe India would continue to honor the treaty. This could lead to even greater conflicts between the two countries in the near future, as both countries are now experiencing severe water crisis. And to give you an example of this, we're just finishing a major documentary, probably or possibly the most comprehensive documentary ever done on the environment, of which global warming is only one part of it. We looked at everything in the documentary. And one of the things we saw, and we took months researching to create the scholarship to support this, was that India, with approximately 3 billion people, had over-farmed its land, did not do anything whatsoever to create a sustainable agriculture, that they brought in with the Green Revolution, genetically engineered seeds, and the tractors that maybe would be used for a 400-acre plot, where before you'd have 400 families each farming an acre, and then at common community markets, the person that grew the almonds would share some almonds with the family that grew the lentils, so that both would have almonds and lentils. And so you see how it went. It was, people were poor, but they weren't hungry. Now they're poor and hungry. So then about 15 years ago, the idea was that why not farm the land for water? So amazingly, people would get these jerry-rigged water containers, frequently about 500 gallons, and they would go to their plot of land, they would drill down, and frequently not drill very far, sometimes 20 to 30 feet, and they'd hit water. So a period of a year or two or three or five, they pumped out the water till those holes went dry. Then they'd go to another hole, another hole, another hole. Millions upon millions of these holes were drilled for water. So in effect, one of the leading cash crops in India was water, because they were running out of it in many of the areas. Not in the areas up near the Himalayas, but to much of the rest of India. Now there's no water for at least 600 million people in India. That's a huge number. That's nearly twice the population. Well, America's 332 million, but it gives you an idea how severe it is. But on top of that, there's a compounding problem. And that is that much of the water originates through Pakistan and into this area of the world that's being contested. In fact, there's seven major rivers in the world. I'm not including the Nile, and I'm not including the Amazon, but you know, you talk about the Mekong River, you talk about many of the biggest rivers in India going off to, and it splits, going off in different directions. Now, the Himalayas is losing its glaciers. Tremendous drop in glacier ice, and hence the melt-off in the spring and the summer that supplies the water. Also, India's greatest cities on the water have not kept up with any public works to the treatment of the water. So water treatment plants are frequently out of chemicals, broken, and so non-filtered, dirty water, toxic water, deadly water is what the average Indian is exposed to. Now, if you're a poor, holy person in India, and there are many, you go down to the river, the Ganges, and you go in and you bathe, you do your religious ceremonies. Many people wash their clothes there. Dead bodies are floating down it. And in some cases, human excrement is so thick that there's the bubbles, methane bubbles coming up constantly, and yet instead of putting their money and resources into becoming more energy efficient and cleaning up their water supply, they've avoided that completely under Modi and before him. This goes back at least 30 years, and now you have drought, you have water scarcity, you have a growing population who doesn't have the basics of life. And when they do have water, they have dirty water that could kill you, and does, and many babies. So if the cleanest water in the whole region is in Kashmir, and if the water that separates out going into different directions is in that part of the Himalayas at the base and then Kashmir at the base of the Himalayas and also Pakistan, then Pakistan actually controls a lot of the water that India gets. India doesn't like that. So when you start looking at what really is the conflict about, you cannot take off the table water as one of the principal problems. And with the military might of India, and India having the United States as a supporting ally, and Pakistan has been supported because of its nuclear arsenal, and not as much as India, and we do more trade with India than we do with Pakistan, and we're going to look at this not in cost of human suffering and human solutions, but rather in economics. What's good for business in America? What does Wall Street say? Whose side should we come down on? Then when I pull back and I'm seeing that this is not going to end well, I see some major confrontations. I don't believe it will go nuclear because as dumb as they are, that is bone stupid dumb. But I do see that they're not going to allow Kashmir to become autonomous. They're not going to allow Kashmir to control the water and much of the food that is grown. Your thoughts, please.
Well, you know, you have given a very, very good overview about the crisis because of the water situation. But let me just also give you a little perspective that most of the water that goes to Pakistan comes from the Kashmir region and the region that is controlled by India. So the problem is really the other way around, that Pakistan is extremely worried that India could disregard the treaties that they've had in the past in which they were sharing the waters coming from the Kashmir mountains going to Pakistan. And if that happens, then there is a tremendous issue between India and Pakistan, because Pakistan's survival depends on this water coming in, because most of that water at this stage does not go to India. It does flow into the Pakistan area. Out of their five rivers, four of them flows from the Kashmir region, which is controlled by India. Now, so Pakistan is tremendously concerned, and if you're talking about issues of talking about nuclear war, this is a life and death issue for them, the water. Now, I don't think Pakistan has much to say in terms of controlling of the water. It's the other way around. It's India controls the water, and Pakistan's major concern has been that this water should not stop coming in. So far that I understand, the treaty is still working. I do not know the elements and recently what is taking place. But that is a tremendous possibilities of crisis between India and Pakistan, because yes, India has lots of problems on the water. It's possible that some of that water could be diverted. Instead of going into Pakistan, it goes into the northern India. That is a possibility. So I would say that yes, the water is critical, but that water is critical much more for Pakistan than even for India. It's also bad for India with the situation that they're in. But the water from Kashmir goes the other way.
Well, no,
that's the reason I say.
Unfortunately, I believe you misunderstood me. I said that the water, these rivers, originate from the melt of the Himalayas, which goes through Kashmir. So whoever controls Kashmir ultimately controls the water. And both countries are in water shortage. Pakistan is short. India is short. The difference is India is a whole lot larger than Pakistan, with a huge population that dwarfs that of Pakistan, and India has the greater military might. Pakistan might have 70 to 100 nuclear weapons, but the international community, including the United States, is not going to condone Pakistan using those nuclear weapons. Pakistan and India have historically had a lot of fighting since the partition in 1947. But when almost everyone who studies the situation where it comes, Africa, South America, the Middle East, says that the major wars in the future will be fought over food, land, and water. Because without water and without food, then the vast majority of people, not the rich, they can go wherever there's food and water and buy it, pay whatever they have to. So we're looking at something that I believe is the crux of it, in which case there should be an effort for India to respect the autonomy of Kashmir, which it's refused to do and hasn't. It's a police state now. And it wouldn't be just because Kashmir was doing anything wrong. Kashmir has done nothing wrong. Kashmir has not engaged in anything that represents a threat to India. But this Modi is going to be like Trump, whoever is in his ear, who's he going to listen to at the moment? And if he feels that somehow the water that's needed for one-third of the Indian population, that's a huge number. Nowhere else in the world do you have that many people who are water insecure. And if he feels that the future of his own country is that they must have that water, and then he can decide whether to continue honoring the treaty and share it with Pakistan or not, and there's where your international pressure comes from people who at the UN and other places say, look, you both have to share this water. All right? You have a treaty, share it to reduce conflict. A person that's a megalomaniac, a person that's a sociopath, and I believe Modi is by his actions, I've studied them carefully, then I do not see a good outcome to this until there is another prime minister in India that is equal to the prime minister in Pakistan in wanting positive nonviolent solutions and allowing Kashmir to become fully autonomous and to be able to function as a provider of water to all regions and not be fought over. Your final thoughts on this, please.
Well, I agree with your summarization. My thoughts are that a person coming from the Kashmir region still have families and close to lots of people. My objective is to see how we can help the situation and how we can create an opportunity from this crisis. Because I again said, crisis does create an opportunity. I think with time is going to tell what this policy that India has, what its consequences are going to be. So I believe that giving Kashmiris opportunities to govern themselves with dignity, I think is important. That's what we have stood for all along. And I have had meetings with all the leadership, senior leadership of India and Pakistan and many of the leaders in the Kashmir region. I think that is the opportunity and the solution. Otherwise, it's not good for India or for Pakistan, and certainly not good for the people of Kashmir.
I agree. I want to thank you very much, Farooq, for coming on today to share your thoughts. And I continue to wish you well and fully support all of your efforts at trying to bring peace to an area of the world that is completely neglected by the mainstream media, certainly in the United States. My hope is that this audience will have understood the seriousness of the situation when you have two nuclear powers and you're squaring off on ideological and environmental issues. You need people who do not have any agenda except healing the wounds, and that's exactly what you're doing with your group. So thank you very much for all your efforts.
And thank you very much for this opportunity.
My guest, Farooq Khatwari, that's Khatwaree, and he is, Khatwari, and he has been my guest today. We have another segment. There's a man in Great Britain on the BBC. He's an outstanding interviewer. He does not bear fools well. He's not afraid to confront people. He's not looking to sugarcoat anything. And his name is Bennett. And here on a special, he is talking with the Minister of Public Information of the government, the official government spokesperson, on the Palestinian and the Israeli conflicts. Now, you would never, and I mean never, hear anyone on CNN or someone for the New York Times or MSNBC challenging him as he gets challenged here. It's a worthy conversation.
You've said, and I'm quoting you again, the ship of Israel's security has sailed in the wrong direction. It seems to me that what you're saying is that, particularly with regard to Gaza, what Israel has done in recent years, including, let us not forget, several wars, the last of which in 2014, Operation Protective Edge, killed more than 2,000 Palestinians. The UN says at least 65% of those Palestinians killed were civilians, and we know that hundreds of them were children. You're saying that Israel's besieging tactics in Gaza, the fact that Gaza doesn't really have power supplies that work, it doesn't have clean water, it has a jobless rate of 60% or more, you're saying all of this isn't tough enough, that Israel should be hammering Gaza harder. Is that it?
No, I said we should be hammering Hamas harder. I have no issue whatsoever with the Gazan people. I have big issues with Hamas, whose charter and actions clearly state that they want to annihilate every Jew in Israel. They say explicitly, we want to kill all the Jews. And by the way, they shoot thousands of missiles at Israel. I think indeed Israel has to be much tougher on our enemies, and we have to, yes, kill every terrorist who shoots a rocket at us, something we've not been doing for quite a few years.
Just look at the record, Mr. Bennett. I don't want to repeat myself, that the last big assault on Gaza killed more than 2,000 Palestinians, most of whom were civilian. We see in our media every week the images of the standoff between Palestinian protesters who have, sometimes they have stones, sometimes they have flaming torches. They go to the fence, they are shot by Israeli service personnel. We have seen more than 100 killed, thousands wounded. And you're telling me that you want the Israeli army and the Israeli air force to up the ante and kill more people. That's what you're saying.
I have a better suggestion, that the Palestinians stop shooting rockets at Israel.
I don't know if you're maybe not understanding my question, but when you respond to the rocket fire that we saw as part of that recent flare-up in Gaza, you respond with your air force, sometimes you respond with troops on the ground. But the reality is, and the record shows it, that the people who suffer are the civilian population, including children. That is the reality, and you want more of it.
No, that is the reality because the Hamas, cowardly, hides behind its own children. You know, all this talk about proportionality, if you were walking on the street and from a residential home someone was shooting at you, you'd shoot back. You wouldn't be asking who's in that home. Anyone who shoots at my kids, I'm going to shoot back. And the only proportions I can think about are of the coffin of that terrorist who's shooting at me.
Let's talk about the reality of the UN reaction. We've seen the recent, now he's retired, but the recent UN Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayed Raad Hussein, say that Israel's response is suggestive of something entirely and wholly disproportionate. And he looks at the casualty figures on the Palestinian side. We also know that the International Criminal Court is still investigating what you did in Operation Protective Edge in 2014. Do you understand that the scrutiny being brought to bear upon Israel goes right through the international community and runs the risk of tarnishing Israel's reputation in a very significant way?
Here's an idea. I would relocate the International Criminal Court to the outskirts of Gaza for just 1 week and feel what the citizens of Israel, of Sderot, feel when they're attacked by 530 rockets in one day. For heaven's sake, let me be clear. We have no claims whatsoever for Gaza. Let them lead their lives. We pulled out of Gaza. We pulled out our army from Gaza. We handed the keys to Mahmoud Abbas, and these people have decided to shoot at us. So when they stop attacking, will be the day there'll be peace. We have no claims. No, we don't want anything from them. Just want them to lead their lives and let us lead our lives.
Thing is,
and they're not doing that. As long as they continue attacking us, we will fight back, regardless of the hypocrisy of the international institutions, which are just a big a home of hypocrisy.
Well, I understand that you have serious political ambition, and we've discussed the politicking you've been involved in recent days. But the problem is, it isn't just the international community that thinks with your uber hawkish stance that you're going far too far. Even the Israeli army thinks you're going far too far, because in recent days you've been criticizing the army itself. You say, this is a quote from you just a few days ago, "We impose countless restrictions on our own soldiers, legal as well as mental. Our fighters are more afraid of the military advocate general than they are of Hamas's leaders." You were immediately rebuked by the IDF chief of staff for saying that. He said you got it plain wrong.
You know, the International Criminal Court was founded after Second World War as a lesson how to prevent genocide and those sort of situations where there's a lawless area. It has nothing to do with what's going on here. Here it's really simple.
I'm not asking you about the ICC anymore.
And we're fighting back. And we will continue to fight back, regardless of all these legal shackles. Yes, I want to remove them because I think it's immoral. It's profoundly immoral to show your second cheek to an enemy who's trying to kill you.
But Mr. Bennett, I'm saying,
for heaven's sakes, stop trying to kill the Jews. That's all. It's a really simple suggestion, and that's all they need to do.
But it's a simple suggestion, but it is not an answer in any way to my question. My question was about the IDF chief of staff, Gadi Eisenkot, rebuking you for criticizing the army's own military advocate general. The chief of staff responded by saying, "Never mind what Mr. Bennett says, the military advocate general is part of the IDF strength." So your contention that the IDF is fighting with one hand tied behind its back is denied even by the IDF itself.
Look, the IDF has a mission. It's to win wars. It's to beat our enemies. Our goal as the political level is to provide them the freedom of action to go do the job. And I think that if the Jewish state wants to be here 50 years from now and 200 years from now, we have to focus on one thing: getting our enemies to understand that it'll never work. Whatever they do will not work. We're here to stay. And then and only then we'll be able to reach sustainable peace.
You've never been a big fan of the Europeans in terms of their view of what's happening in Israel. You've never been a big fan of the ICC. You are a huge fan, or at least you have been, of Donald Trump. You've talked about your deep respect for him. You've talked about him as Israel's best friend. Are you a little bit worried that the signals we are getting from Washington now suggest that Donald Trump has decided, and he says he's going to launch this deal of the century, a peace proposal for Israel-Palestine, he has decided, and he said this in September, that he thinks a two-state solution would work best? Are you worried about that?
Yes. Well, you know, any plan that President Trump has, we first of all will take a serious look at it and a respectful look at it. At the end of the day, we'll do what serves Israel's best interests, because we live here, we're going to live here for the next thousands of years, and we have to take care of our future.
Yeah, well,
anything that he presents to us, we'll take a serious look at.
Well, you'll have to take a very serious look, won't you, given the degree of support that the Trump administration has given to you and your government. And this is what Donald Trump said. He said, "Israel will have to pay a higher price because they won a very big thing." Of course, he was talking about the U.S. decision to move the embassy to Jerusalem. He said, "Previously, they," that is the negotiators, "could never get past the fact of Jerusalem becoming the capital, but now that's off the table. There's nothing more to negotiate. So they," the Palestinians, "will get something very good now because it's their turn next." That's the reality you're going to have to deal with.
I'm very supportive. I think he's right that Jerusalem has been taken off the table, and that's great news for the future of the Israeli-Palestinian relationship. At the end of the day, you know, I don't want to speculate. We'll see what comes, and we'll take it by that.
I guess the fundamental problem that people in Israel and outside Israel ask of you, Mr. Bennett, is what is your long-term strategic vision for your country? You're a guy who is absolutely steadfastly opposed to a two state solution. You say you want to annex all of the land upon which the Jewish settlements sit in the occupied West Bank, but you don't want to offer citizenship to the Palestinian population of the West Bank. To many people inside Israel, and one could go back to former prime ministers like Ehud Olmert and Ehud Barak, but also leader of the opposition, Tzipi Livni, they say that if Israel pursues your vision, it will end up being an apartheid-style state.
They're flatly wrong. There is a two-state solution right now. There's a Palestinian full-fledged state in Gaza, and it's been a huge and an unmitigated disaster. So you tried it out once. We're not going to try it out again on a bigger scale when it failed so colossally in Gaza.
If you intended to lay siege to the West Bank as you did to Gaza, there might be some relevance to that. But of course, that's not on the table because you've got all these Jewish settlements which you intend to annex. It comes back to this basic question: if Israel pursued your vision, you would end up with a population before too long that was majority Arab-Palestinian, and yet you would not countenance giving them a full free voice in a democratic system. So you would be violating democratic values and international law.
That was interesting, and boy, could American journalists learn something about doing an interview and being prepared and doing their homework prior to that. Unfortunately, in the United States, more often than not, our journalists, at least the mainstream journalists, come into an argument with only one side of an issue they prepared for, defend their particular positions. And that this was a challenge that. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for watching and listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day.
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother,
I can dig it.
Stop right on.
Hey, man.